It's now time for the Fantasy 411 podcast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Fantasy 411. I know what you're thinking. Where's Matthew Leach? Matthew is having a well-deserved vacation right now, so I, Fred Zinke, am going to put a new hat on this week and host the podcast, and I'm really excited this week to have Steve Adams with me. Steve works with us here at MLB.com and also works at MLB Trade Rumors. He's a busy guy, but he's cleared some time this week to join me on the podcast. Steve, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Looking forward to offering some insight this week, or whatever I can anyway. So hopefully it'll be good.
Awesome. Let's jump right into it. We're going to start with hitters today. And let's talk Yulieski Gurriel, because he's come to the majors. He hasn't done much yet. He has a minor injury. We don't really need to concern ourselves too much, I think, with that injury. But is Gurriel to you someone that you have to have on a roster in every league?
He is for me. Just looking at the body of work that he had in his international career, he has an OPS just under 1,000 in his career between Cuba and Japan combined. He's somebody that Major League scouts have kind of just like looked at and thought, if only, you know, for years, if he were ever to leave Cuba, and now he didn't. He's 32, so he's a bit older, but the body of work is extremely impressive. His final season in Cuba, he, in over 200 plate appearances, hit 500, which is, you know, unfathomable. He's not going to hit, you know, 500, 400, whatever in the majors, obviously, but I mean, he can definitely contribute a really strong batting average. He has some nice right-handed power, and he's in a perfect park for that at Minute Maid, you know, with a short porch. The Crawford box is down the left field line. So, you know, regardless for me of format, you know, he's obviously a must-add in AL-onlys and in deeper mixed leagues, but there's so much upside there that I would take a shot on him in virtually any league, especially one with, you know, keeper implications.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, Matthew and I often talk about how, you know, even in a shallow league, like a 10-team league, everybody has a worst player on their team. The quality of that worst player is different in different formats, but everybody has a worst player on their team. And if you drop your worst player, there's a decent chance that he'll still be there waiting for you in a week if you want to pick him back up. So I feel like even in a shallow league, you know, you can drop your worst player, you can pick up Gurriel just for that upside. Like you were saying, like his numbers in 2015, the Cuban National Series, like those are video game-like numbers, like the kind you only see when you've mastered a video game. And you know, he's not going to do that in the majors, but, you know, he could be, and he's in his prime, you know, for career path, so he could be a really productive hitter once he gets comfortable.
Yeah, agreed.
Moving from someone who might be a really good hitter to someone who wasn't a very good hitter but is now a very good hitter, and we'll see if he will continue to be a very good hitter, and that's Alex Gordon of the Royals. Now, Gordon was, you know, pretty terrible for most of this season, but lately has been hitting home runs in bunches. Steve, do you think that it's time to pick him back up, or did you kind of just miss the hot streak?
Similar thoughts actually to Gurriel here. Is at this point of the season, you know, you're looking at, I like what you said about the worst player in your team. You look at the worst player in your team and the best case scenario for that player, and you compare him to the best case scenario for Alex Gordon, which is kind of what he's been doing over the past 20 games or so. He has, you know, OPS right around 1,000. I think he's homered six times in his past 19 or 20 games. You know, Gordon, when you look at what he's done over the past several years, for me, like, yeah, you have to go and pick him up. And if it comes at the expense of your worst player, even if Gordon craters again and he goes back to the kind of the subpar hitter that he was for the first 4 months, 3 months of the season, you know, you're going to be able to find somebody who is of comparable quality to that worst player that you dropped, if not that same worst player. I think you have to take a chance on a guy with that type of talent and that he's proven over the past, you know, several years. With the power coming back, he's still striking out some, but I mean, he's drawing some walks. His plate discipline numbers look like, you know, they're taking a turn for the better. And he's going to, you know, be right in the middle of that Royals lineup, especially if he keeps sitting like this. You know, they'll move him back up to the middle portion of the lineup. So I think, yeah, whether it's 12-team, 10-team, you have to take a chance and go pick up Gordon at this point.
Yeah, I mean, Gordon's someone who had been really consistent, and this season, like, to put it, like, really simply, he's just swinging and missing more than he ever has before. His swing and miss percentage is way higher. His strikeout rate is way higher, and that's contributed to the low batting average. As you said, he's still walking. He still may steal 10 bases this year, and if he stays hot for a while, he might get 20 home runs. It's just the strikeouts that are holding the batting average down. But, yeah, go for it and pick him up. And, you know, if in the next 7 days he goes, you know, gets four hits and none of them are home runs, then go ahead and send him back to waivers and you miss the hot streak, but you never know if he can continue it. He has been a pretty valuable fantasy asset for many years. So in a shallow league, let's say you're looking on your waiver wire and Alex Gordon's there and so is Keon Broxton, who's really been stuffing the stat sheet recently. Which one of those, Steve, would you rather pick up?
It depends on the specific team needs. If you're looking for overall offensive contribution, Gordon. But if you're looking for purely stolen bases, yeah, I do like Keon Broxton as a pickup. He strikes out a ton, and he has since he's been promoted this year, his strikeout rate's 35-36%. But he has legitimate speed, 17 steals in 55 games, and he's going to get a look down the stretch in Milwaukee as they're kind of trying to figure out, you know, who are the guys that we're going to, you know, have in our lineup on an everyday basis next year. Broxton's someone that they're going to take a look at. If you need stolen bases, he's certainly somebody who intrigues me, as is, I'll throw this back to you and kind of pose the same question. Jose Peraza, another kind of NL Central guy with huge speed that I think is somebody who, you know, teams can benefit from picking up, who may not be widely owned across leagues right now.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a Peraza fan. At the same time, I may rather own Broxton right now just because Peraza's been in the lineup last few days, but Zach Cozart's been out, and Cozart should be back soon. And then I worry about how they'll get Peraza in the lineup, although I just, like, for me, the Reds, you know, the rebuilding Reds have to get Peraza into the lineup, you know, down the stretch. I mean, it's going to be good for his development. And I'm interested to see, you know, with Hamilton and Peraza at the lineup in front of Votto, how that really goes for them. One thing about Broxton, though, that you can't say for Peraza is he does have a little bit of power. He has some respectable home run totals in the minors. And it is this year, six homers in 55 games. So, I mean, if over a full season he could be a 12 or 13, maybe 15 home run and, say, 35, 40 steal guy, you know, now you really have something. I really like those power speed guys who can contribute to your team in multiple ways. Even if they hit for a low batting average, we've seen guys like Leonis Martin, Melvin Upton Jr. have really valuable stretches this season. You know, I think that's a great place for people to target.
Yeah, I agree. And I think you kind of hit the nail on the head there. With unless Broxton takes a step forward in terms of strikeouts, he's not going to hit for a high average. But, you know, I think he homered eight times in the minors this year before he was called up. I think he said six in the majors. So he's definitely got the pop to be that type of mold of player that you said, where, yeah, you can get your, you know, respectable contributions and home runs, but then some really, really meaningful numbers in terms of, you know, bulk of steals over the life of a season. He's definitely somebody that if you're kind of already looking ahead to 2017 and thinking, you know, who are some guys that you may want to target a little bit further down the draft board, you know, I think Broxton's certainly somebody to consider there.
Okay, let's move to someone who we may only need a short discussion on whether this person needs to be owned. Alex Bregman has to be owned in every league, right?
He struggled obviously quite a bit when he first came up, to 0 for 28 or whatever it was to begin his career. But if you look at his numbers since that time, since he kind of figured things out, maybe calmed down and had some luck start going his way, he's hitting 310-ish with, you know, four or five home runs over the course of his past 20 games. And this is somebody who has just been lauded as, you know, the number one or two or three prospect in all of baseball for the better part of the season here, with the numbers that he was putting up in Double A and then in Triple A. The Astros, I mean, with the way he's hitting, they have no choice but to put him in the lineup on an everyday basis. And, you know, if you're in any form of keeper league, Bregman's a must own. And if you're just in a, you know, a shallow 10-team redraft league, I would have Bregman not only on my team, I'd have him in the lineup every single day.
Yeah, if you had to take yes or no on the guess of whether Bregman's a top 100 hitter for the rest of the season, which side would you take?
I would say yes. I would probably say, you know, top 75 or top 50 hitter even potentially, based on, you know, the upside that he's shown in the minor leagues.
Yeah, so I mean that makes him, you know, like someone who has to be in every lineup. He's in that premium lineup spot and in a really top heavy lineup. Moving along, last week Matthew and I discussed Chris Davis and how cold he was, which is crazy because since then I feel like every morning when I turn on the highlights, I see another Chris Davis home run. So he was ice cold for about 3 weeks to start the second half, and now he's red hot. So if you're a Chris Davis owner, we talked last week about the wave that is owning Chris Davis. Just, you know, there's cold, there's really hot, and you know, at the end of the year, you just hope that he had a good year and not a bad year. So if you're a Davis owner now, would you just say, you know, okay, the cold stretch is over, we're good now for the last 6 weeks or so? Or would you say, okay, now is my time to trade him because he's hot and see if I can get that, you know, second or third round type value for him?
I think at this point, if you have a chance to contend and if you're looking to win your league, you ride the wave. You know, you said it yourself, like, he's a very streaky hitter. Home runs come in bunches with him. But the fact of the matter is that when he gets on one of these runs, like, he's has arguably the most power of anybody who's healthy in baseball right now. I don't see – maybe if you strongly need pitching, something like that, and you're really, you know, really a stacked offense in the first place, you can kind of swap out and help out your rotation by moving Davis. But I don't know that you're going to be able to get any kind of more reliable offense that comes with the same level of upside that he has. So for me, it's a ride the wave and hope that, you know, he can stretch this current home run binge out for another couple of weeks at least.
Yeah, I agree. And speaking of home run binges, we saw one from kind of an unlikely source, at least in 2016, an unlikely source this week when Adrian Gonzalez had his 3-homer, 8-RBI game. Really impressive and almost the opposite of what Gonzalez had been the rest of the year, which is just kind of a blah guy who hits, you know, 290-ish and not many home runs and collects his RBIs, but not really exciting. Did the 3-homer, 8-RBI game change your evaluation of him at all?
It didn't. You know, he wasn't exactly facing the greatest pitching in the world when he did have that game. He's still a solid option at first base in mixed leagues. He hits for average, like you said. He's going to drive in runs, and he's not fast enough or to score tons of runs, but he's going to end up the season hitting 300 with between 15 and 20 home runs, between 90 and 100 RBIs, and between, you know, 75 and 80 runs scored. He's a really solid across the board option for first baseman. He just isn't the powerhouse that he was, you know, even 2 years ago. I mean, when he was hitting 30 home runs and knocking in 100 and 110, 120.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, when Adrian Gonzalez got out of bed on August 17th, which is just a week ago, he had 10 home runs and 60 RBIs, which is, you know, just for a corner infielder, not really impressive. He'll hit for average, and so that's cool if that's what you want him for. But yeah, I would like maybe he'll hit 7 more home runs this season, but he has 15 even after that big home run binge. So, you know, he might just finish the year with he might not even get to 20 home runs, which, mm-hmm. you know, going into next year, like, won't make him that, you know, attractive early in draft. Speaking of early in drafts, last week Matthew and I talked about, you know, who might be picked first overall next year. And since we have a fresh voice on the podcast this week, I wanted to throw it over to you, Steve, just for fun. And, I, you know, no one will remember this and hold you to it or anything, but if we were drafted for next year today, who would you think would be in, like, those top 5 picks?
I hate this question, but...
it's a tricky one, but it's one that moves all the time, and that's what makes it kind of cool during the season.
Yeah, it's fun. Trout's still going to be there. He's, you know, going to come up. He's hitting 300. His strikeouts are down. He's running more again. Trout's still going to be there in the top 5, if not number 1 overall. And, you know, for me, I think Mookie Betts, Jose Altuve, Chris Bryant, and I really hate leaving Bryce Harper off of this, but just because of the kind of, I mean, he's looked better lately, but the uncertainty regarding his shoulder or neck or whatever it might be, I would probably put Arenado in that 5th spot. Kershaw is somebody else who maybe they would be in there if he were fully healthy, but, you know, we don't know exactly. We don't even know for sure that he's going to pitch again this season. So I think the 5 guys I listed, you know, Trout, Betts, Altuve, Bryant, Arenado, you know, order them however you want, but they're, you know, premium sources of power who can hit for average, knock in runs, score runs, and almost all of them across the board can contribute in stolen bases as well.
Interesting. I'm surprised you put Arenado ahead of Josh Donaldson. Now, what was your reasoning there? Is it the age factor?
It's the age factor, and it's just the Coors Field factor, honestly. Donaldson, I mean, I should have – Donaldson's somebody that I can also mention is kind of on the fringes there. But, you know, you look at the age discrepancy between them, it's easier for me to see Arenado trending upward just a little bit more and seeing Donaldson trend downward. I'm not expecting either, you know, Donaldson to fall off a cliff or take a step back or anything next year. And if I were listing top 8 or top 10, like he would be in there. But it's tough when you're, you know, kind of narrowing it down to those top 5 guys. But I love everything about Nolan Arenado, and I think he's just gonna keep getting better. And that Rockies lineup has a lot of young talent. He's gonna have an improved supporting cast next year potentially. You know, get a full season of David Dahl in there. Full season of Trevor Story in there. There's a lot to like about that Rockies lineup next year.
It's very true. And the Blue Jays lineup, you know, with Jose Bautista and Edwin Encarnacion being free agents at the end of this season, you know, Donaldson, a lot of his values come with the massive run scored in RBI totals. So we'll just have to see how that whole thing plays out. I think maybe the main takeaway from this is that the middle or second half of the first round may not be a bad place to land next year when we're talking about guys like Kershaw and Donaldson and Harper outside possibly of those top 5 picks. I could see Harper, as you mentioned, like if he has a strong finish, getting back up into the top 5 or maybe even the top 3, who knows. And, I mean, we didn't even mention Manny Machado, Anthony Rizzo,
right,
like some really good hitters. Picking, you know, 8, 9, 10 next year, you know, could be totally fine.
Yeah, there's, especially if you're toward the end of that first round and you can get a chance to maybe even pick up two of those guys, you know, you have the turnaround there at the end of the snake draft, you can get some really good talent, and it's really easy to see, you know, Kershaw comes back healthy or Harper's healthy for the whole season, and suddenly, you know, you have like a potential top overall talent that kind of fell into your lap, maybe 7 or 8 picks later than they would have gone otherwise.
Yeah, I agree. Let's move off. I kind of bunched the first round in with the hitters because it's going to be really hitter heavy next year. But now let's move on to some starting pitchers. Talk about a couple of really hot starters, David Phelps and Robbie Ray. Which one, Steve, would you rather own and why? Because they're both being scooped up really quickly in mixed leagues.
For me, I like both of them quite a bit. I would lean toward Phelps right now just because he hasn't had the home run issues that Ray has kind of dealt with this season. But they're both guys who, you know, miss tons of bats. They keep the ball on the ground, which is huge. And they have pretty comparable control. I also just think, you know, the Marlins are going to give Phelps more of an opportunity to pick up wins over the course of the final month of the season. The Diamondbacks have, you know, obviously struggled quite a bit this year. And he's, you know, I know Phelps has been in the bullpen for most of the season, but in a way that's almost a bonus. You know, he threw 115-ish innings last year, and he's around 75 this year. And so if you want to, you know, kind of go with the fresh arm debate, you know, Robbie Ray's already exceeded his innings total in the majors from last season. And so you kind of wonder, all right, this is like uncharted territory for Ray in terms of workload as a major league starter, whereas Phelps, you know, hasn't even touched the innings total that he had last year, even come close to it. So I do like both of them, but I think Phelps kind of just gives you a little bit of a safer call with more wins too.
Yeah, I could definitely see that with his, you know, with the teams. I mean, the Diamondbacks are probably, you know, one of your poorest bets to win games late in the season, and they don't play good defense. I mean, getting A.J. Pollock back will probably help, but their bullpen is really messy right now. So, and Ray's not someone who throws 8 innings. So, yeah, I think the wins could matter a lot. I kind of lean Phelps too, unless I was really hard chasing strikeouts, and then I might, you know, take on Ray. And owners have those weird situations late in the season where maybe certain categories matter much more than others. Now I'm going to jump way west to Seattle and talk about two different Mariners pitchers. First, Felix Hernandez, is he good again?
I think that's the same question that the Mariners and all their fans are asking. He's been really encouraging, but in terms of the missed bats and the strikeouts, the walks are still a bit of a concern for me. You know, this is in Felix's prime, he was a guy who not only missed bats, but he walked virtually no one. And you still see him, even in some of these 8-9 strikeout starts that he's had lately, he's still issuing 4 walks here and there. I think I feel better about him than I would have, you know, a couple months ago even. But it's still concerning for me. The velocity still isn't anywhere near what it was. He's good again, but I don't know that he's great again, and I don't know that he's somebody that I'm going to look at as a top-tier starter over the final month of the season.
Yeah, I think he's improved from being – I felt like he was pretty scary earlier in the season in the sense of he had blow-up potential and he wasn't getting a lot of strikeouts, and that's a bad combination. But He is walking more batters, but maybe this is his way of working around his reduced velocity, kind of nibbling a little more. He only walked one batter last start, and that's against a Brewers team that likes to draw walks. So, and the strikeouts, eight strikeouts in four of his last five starts. So I feel like he's someone you plug and play now and don't take him out of your lineup unless you see any other, really bad starts. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I do.
And then sticking with the Mariners, Taiwan Walker came back last night. He was not very good. He's been really inconsistent the past couple seasons. Would you feel pretty comfortable in like a 10 or a 12 team league just dropping him if you don't feel comfortable using him in the next week or two?
I would. And the thing with Walker is he's a guy who there have been injury concerns around him forever. And I don't want to speculate and say that there's anything wrong with him or whatever, but durability has been something that people have been worried about. And you look at, he's up over 100 innings this season. He's not a guy who's, amassed tons of innings in previous seasons. I know he got over the 160 mark last year, but this isn't a workload that we see from him on a yearly basis. So he's very talented, but he wasn't even particularly impressive in his brief stint in the minor leagues, and he was inconsistent in the starts leading up to that going back to AAA. And so, especially if you're in a 10 team league, I think you're going to be able to find comparable starting pitchers on free agency. And if you're in a 12 teamer, it's a little bit tougher, but the same kind of thing. Like there are guys out there who come with plenty of upside, and we're going to see some interesting names come up in September as well. That maybe give you a chance, at some strikeouts and some good starts. And we're going to see a lot of weaker September lineups too, for some of those guys to be facing. So I think you can kind of find decent pitching that you can take advantage of on a case by case basis throughout the month of September.
Yeah, and I mean, Walker's definitely the past couple of years, like, really up and down. Seems kind of, not temperamental as far as his mental temperament goes, but just seems like he needs everything. If everything's not really aligned for him, then the starts can be really ugly. And he'll be an interesting case this offseason heading into 2017 as far as, he still has a lot of potential, and he's had some really good stretches, but it's really hard. It'll be really hard next season to project 30 starts at that potential because he just hasn't been able to put it together. Speaking of players who haven't put much together this year, Shelby Miller may be back soon. Are there any leagues where you would pick him up?
It's so hard to know what to expect from him, but I would, just because if you look at, and if you're talking about a guy like this, their Triple A success may not speak volumes, because you expect a pitcher of Shelby Miller's caliber to go down and carve up Triple A pitching, but he has pitched really well down in Triple A, not just in terms of ERA. He's been missing bats, and he hasn't been walking people, which is huge for him. It points to improved control, improved mechanics, whatever it might be. He has plenty of upside, obviously. I know I kind of just went the opposite route with Walker on this, but this is a guy who's been there. He's done it before. Like you said earlier, the Diamondbacks defense is going to be getting better with the return of AJ Pollock. There's, to me, a lot to like based on what we've seen in terms of him taking steps forward with strikeouts and walks at AAA. And while there is quality pitching out there, it's tough to match up, find one of those guys who could consistently deliver the quality innings that Shelby Miller has in the past and could do over the final months.
Agreed. And I think I'm not quite as optimistic on Miller as you are, but that being said, I think Miller's way further down the fantasy totem pole right now and in most people's eyes than Taiwan Walker. And like, you'll find Miller on waivers in basically any mixed league. So, we could just be saying, in 15-team leagues, or if you just feel like you have empty bench space, he's someone to pick up. Doesn't necessarily mean you'd add him over Walker, although you might. But, I think he's going to be more readily available. And, it's all about the acquisition cost and what you have to, replace on your roster to get him, who you have to let go to get him. So, and that, that makes a big difference. His fantasy value right now, it's pretty much rock bottom.
It's bottomed out entirely, and I wouldn't necessarily cut my worst starter in, say, a 10-team league where your worst starter is probably pretty good if you're still in the mix. But yeah, if you're in a 12-team or a 14-team, something like that, and you just need some quality innings down the stretch, I think there are far worse players that you could, take a chance on than Shelby Miller. And really, if he comes back up and in his first start he looks terrible, and you put him on your bench for the second start and he looks terrible again, you can cut him, and you're not really costing yourself all that much. But the upside for at least taking a shot on him is pretty substantial.
Yeah, I agreed. Going to look at Jake Arrieta now for a minute, and he's been kind of all over the map. It was awesome last night against the Padres. Mm-hmm. Not the hardest thing in the world to do.
No.
But walked seven Brewers, his previous start. Where are you on Arrieta? Like, top five starter, top 10 starter? Are you worried about him?
I'm worried about just the diminished control from last season. You know, his velocity is down a little bit, but not to the point where it's of a major concern for me. I think, you know, you see guys get into their 30s and a little bit of velocity comes off. It's not the end of the world, and I don't think he's even down a full mile an hour from last year. But the walks definitely concern me, you know, and with that comes a bit lower strikeout rate because, you know, he's not getting himself into as many favorable counts. He's just not locating as well as he did last year when he was so unbeatable. I think, you know, the second half of last season and the first half of this season gave us kind of some superhuman expectations for Arrieta. If I have to put him in, I'd put him in the top 10 starters still, I suppose, because I would have more confidence in him than the majority of starters around the league. Top five is tough. You know, there's some really good arms out there. But he's still, for me, a top-tier starter. He was going through a bit of a rough patch, but I think just knowing what the upside there is, he's not somebody that you need to shy away from or you know, bench in certain leagues. I don't think I'd have him in the lineup regardless of opponent and regardless of matchup still.
Yeah, I mean, and pitching for the Cubs certainly helps, like with his win total. And yeah, you're right, though. It's the control from 2014 to 2015. You know, he's pretty much around two walks per nine innings this year, about 3.5. And that's really the big difference with him. You know, hit rate isn't really any different. Home run rate's up a little bit, but it was microscopic last season. So it's still low.
He was never going to repeat that home run rate anyway.
Those walks. Yeah, it'll just be to reducing those walks that'll decide probably whether he is like a top 12 starter or something like that, or the top five starter that, you know, well, last year he was a top maybe two starter for most of the season, him and Kershaw. So, anyways, yeah, I've always been an Arrieta fan, so I'm going to still think positively on him. I was really happy to see him miss the trip to Coors Field last weekend, I'll be honest, because I didn't feel like that was the best place for him to pitch after the seven-walk start. So San Diego is maybe a nice way for him to get back on track. Also wanted to mention, in that seven-walk start, Wilson Contreras was his catcher for the first time ever. It didn't work out so hot. So, I mean, they do have options there with Miguel Montero.
Yeah.
Moving on, we're going to talk some bullpens now. Let's start with the Marlins. Who gets more saves the rest of the season, A.J. Ramos or Fernando Rodney?
I would lean toward Ramos. I think he's just, when it comes down to it, he's the better pitcher of the two. And eventually you're just going to want, Mattingly probably is going to want his best arm in those situations. Rodney has been terrific this season, but he's also, I've owned Rodney in multiple leagues over the course of the season, and it's terrifying just seeing his name in your lineup sometimes because you know of the, you know, the blow-ups that he's kind of prone to. He's pitched fine for the Marlins, but when it comes down to it, I think, you know, you gravitate toward the guy who you think is the better of the two pitchers, and that, you know, 2016 numbers aside, is still A.J. Ramos for me.
Yeah, and I mean, yeah, I agree that Ramos is a better pitcher, and I think that's where they'll end up, you know, with him back in that thing. And he didn't really do anything to lose the job. He had a couple, you know, sketchy outings right before he went on the disabled list, but overall this season he's been pretty effective. Let's go to Arizona now. Does Arizona have a closer? And if they do have a closer, does it matter?
I don't know if they have a closer or not right now. I think you'll eventually see Enrique Burgos kind of maybe emerge in that role just based on, you know, the bats that he misses and the fact that they just don't really have a lot of other options. If it's Burgos and you just really need saves, he can probably accumulate a few over the final month of the season, and he misses a lot of bats. He's striking out almost 10 per nine, but the control isn't great. He's not going to help you in whiff, and because of that, like he is prone to those, you know, massive blown saves that can really be detrimental, especially at this point of the season. Unless you 100% need saves, I think I would just steer clear of the entire Arizona bullpen carousel because the risk there kind of outweighs the reward.
Yeah, I agree with you. And, you know, his control, like, on the season, really poor. But I will, when you look at his game log, his control in the last month, much, much better. And the strikeouts are still there. So that's encouraging. You know, he did blow a save chance, you know, his last appearance. That's not so encouraging. And, you know, we do worry about how many save chances the Diamondbacks will get him. I think at best, 12-team league. I can't see in a 10-team league needing to use him.
No.
In a 12-team league, you know, that's someone might need a third closer down the stretch, and he could probably be that guy if there's nobody else on waivers. But now comparing him, say, to everyone on the Angels, because the Angels are closerless right now. It won't be Houston Street. It could be Cam Bedrosian at some point, but it's not now. Are there any Angels relievers that are healthy right now that you would want to own in any mixed league?
You know, I think I would stay away there as well. The hope, you know, if you're looking at the Angels bullpen, the hope is that Bedrosian comes back at some point this season, because then, you know, if he's healthy and closing, he's not only like a serviceable option, he's a must own top tier option based on what he's done this year. You know, with a ERA right around one, tons of strikeouts, respectable control, good ground ball rate. But in the interim, there's just not any. There really aren't any arms at the back of that bullpen that I trust to provide, you know, useful enough ratios to even pursue those, you know, maybe the one or two or three saves that you might get out of them. The Angels, I mean, like you said, in reference to the Diamondbacks, they're not going to be in that many save opportunities over the course of the rest of the season. They're an injury-ravaged team right now. Their rotation is kind of in shambles. I don't look at that team and think there's going to be a lot of save opportunities. And chasing after them with guys who are going to be pitching often in you know, blowout situations and in non-save situations where they're at risk of really damaging, you know, your ratios is just not worth it to me.
Yeah, I mean, and I mean, I think their value will also depend on the type of transactions you have in your league. So in a daily transaction league, it's fine to pick up these closers on teams that aren't very competitive down the stretch and, you know, shuttle them in and out of your lineup as best you can and hope you get some extra saves from them. In a weekly transaction league, if you think a team like the Diamondbacks or the Angels, if they're in, a standard six-game week, you know, unless their schedule looks really favorable, if you're projecting maybe two wins that week out of the six games, you know, at the end, and you know, one of those wins may not come with a save chance, you might be looking at the end of the week, you used one of your roster spots on your lineup spots on a closer who threw two innings and got one save. And, you know, that when you compare that to what you could, if you still need wins, to putting in a starter who could get you five or six strikeouts or even a two-start pitcher. Like, it's tough in those weekly transaction leagues, you know, to use those closers that may not be used a lot and could come in and not pitch well.
Yeah, I think especially if you're in a weekly league, I think you really want to have a guy who has the job solidified and not somebody who's, you know, part of a potential committee and who, even when they do pitch, isn't a massive risk to hurt your ratios if they're in a non-safe situation. And I don't think there really are many of those on the Diamondbacks and especially on the Angels.
Agreed. Let's look at some injured players. Giancarlo Stanton, are there any leagues where you would stash him, or are you expecting that if he does make it back this season, it'll be so late that it just won't matter?
I have stashed him in a couple of leagues, actually, when he's been dropped, just on the off chance. To me, if you have the DL spot available, use it. You know, I mean, who better to fill that spot with than Giancarlo Stanton? Even if he comes back for a week at the end of the season, you know, we're not talking about a wrist injury necessarily or like a hand injury where you might think, oh, he's going to come back and not have the full strength in his upper body. You know, obviously your lower half is important in hitting, so I don't want to like downplay the severity of his injury, but I feel better stashing him and hoping for a few, you know, a couple home runs late in the season than I would if he had gotten hit on the wrist, you know, in mid-August or, you know, mid-July or something like that, and was going to come back the final weekend of September.
Now, I know they play different positions, and that matters, but just let's forget that in kind of in a vacuum. If you owned both Stanton, or let's say you owned Steven Matz and Stanton was available in your league, and Matz may only be out for a couple weeks, but when he comes back, who knows how effective he'll be, how many starts he'll make. Would you rather take Matz and keep Matz in your DL spot and hope for maybe five starts at the end of the season, or would you rather stash the upside of Stanton and hope that maybe you get a week or two of a first round type player?
In this, you know, especially in this season, I would keep Matz there just because the bulk of value. You know, the Mets are saying it's only going to be one start, and I feel like they would say that whether they think it's going to be one start or whether they think it might be four.
Totally.
But, you know, he's well, teams don't come out and necessarily say, hey, our great starter is going to be out for the next however many weeks to their opponents this late in the year when they're in a contending, you know, for a playoff spot. But, yeah, I think, you know, if you look at the upside of maybe four or five starts out of Mapp, you might only get four or five total games out of Stanton, and it's not like he was in the middle of his best season anyway when he was healthy. He had been heating up, of course, but Mass has been pretty consistently good. You know, his last start before he went on the disabled list was one of his best of the year, one of the best of his career. So it's a bit concerning because, you know, he has the bone spur and now some shoulder pain, discomfort, whatever you want to call it, but the volume that Matt can provide you right now is worth more to me than the potential for Stanton, who we don't even 100% know is going to come back sometime this year. We do expect that Matt will.
Yeah, and another starter who's supposed to be out for a short amount of time is Steven Strasburg, and, you know, he's only expected, I guess, to miss a couple of weeks. You know, what do you expect from Strasburg once he comes back? Like, where does he rank to you, like, among starters for the rest of the season? Is he still a top 20 starter, even just with a couple of missed starts?
Yeah, I think he is. I think you have to look at him that way. I know he struggled leading up to the CL stint, but he has said that you know, if this were the postseason, you know, he'd be pitching through this right now. And you know, the Nationals, good team, they're going to provide him with plenty of chances for wins. And he's, you know, with the exception of these past three starts, which, you know, maybe just taking a couple of weeks off to kind of take a step back, get his arm fresh, and kind of heal back up will make a big difference. There's way too much benefit there for me not to consider him, you know, among the top 20, top 15-ish starters in the league for the rest of the season. So
now, because this is the second time he's been on the DL this season, you know, looking ahead to 2017, and we don't want to get too deep into that right now, but I mean, can you put him in your, he's not injury prone in the sense of missing whole seasons really, but seems to always have things happen in the course of a season. Like, how many starts do you think you can project him for, and how high could you really rank him?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that you can say, okay, well, Strasburg's going to go out and make his 33 starts like he does every year and throw his 220 innings, because that's not the guy he's proven to be. At the same time, you know, the Nationals felt comfortable enough in his long-term durability to say, hey, we're going to sign this guy for 7 years. So, you know, they know better than anybody what, you know, kind of what the medicals look like there and what the risk is going to be. I think I would, if I were going to make a projection on him, I would probably err on the side of caution and say, okay, 27, 28 starts next year. And if he does go above and beyond that and he does give you 32, 33 starts, that's great and it's a bonus. But the ratios that he can provide and the mass volume of strikeouts on a good team that's going to, you know, give him, again, plenty of opportunities to pick up wins over the course of the season, he's still, for me, a top-tier starter next season, even if he might have a bit of concern for some, you know, kind of myriad injuries that aren't necessarily connected to one another. Like you said, it's not, hey, his elbow gives out every season. It's, he kind of seems to have just some random things flare up here and there.
Yeah, I mean, assuming he makes a few starts at the end of this season, 28 starts will be basically his five-year average at the end of this year. And as far as innings go, you know, somewhere around 180. So mm-hmm. I think that's kind of where you project him. It's just it might be hard to get him into those top 10 starters at 180 innings. Now, his strikeout rate is so good that at 180 innings, you might be able to project him for 220 strikeouts or something like that, which makes up for a lot. So maybe he can get in the top 10 anyways. You know, him and Stanton, although different injuries and different types of things, quite similar in the way that, you know, they're really good, but they're just something seems to happen most seasons where they just don't end up playing the full 6 months, and after a while, you know, I've heard many people debate the difference between unlucky and injury-prone, and, you know, they're starting to sway towards that injury-prone.
Yeah, it's the same kind of debate we had during his prime anyway with Troy Tulowitzki for years. It's, you know, hey, it's always something different, and sometimes it's bad luck that he just got hit by a pitch or whatever, but at the end of the season, you're always looking at, you know, maybe 110 games as opposed to 162, and I think people are right to kind of have that concern about Stanton. Even though they're not all related, something does seem to happen, and you just kind of wonder if, yeah, like I said, for whatever reason, he's just kind of more susceptible to injuries than your standard player.
Yeah. Someone who's coming back really soon, A.J. Pollock, he could be back even by the end of this week. How good do you think he can be for the last 5 weeks of the season? Like, he was you know, prior to getting injured, you know, earlier this season, a top five outfielder. You know, he was going late first, early second round in a lot of leagues. Do you think we see 100% A.J. Pollock down the stretch?
Man, 100% is a lot to expect for a guy who hasn't faced major league pitching all season. But at the same time, he's been great, and it's only 11 games in the minors, but he's been outstanding. He's hitting .400 down there. And he's, you know, when we were talking earlier this podcast about the Keon Broxton types, who maybe they can hit 12 home runs and steal 40 bases, he's that plus actually hitting for solid average. He has to be owned, I think. In pretty much any format, you have to pick him up and run with him down the stretch. Even if you only get maybe 80% of A.J. Pollock, you're still going to have a useful batting average with a bit of power, plenty of speed, and the Diamondbacks are going to play him, you know, every day unless some kind of injury, you know, flares up. They need to see how healthy he is and make sure that they can feel comfortable relying on him as their everyday center fielder next season. He's going to be in the lineup. And for me, there's the potential that he brings basically outpaces that of almost any teams. You know, you take the third or fourth best outfielder on any team. You know, A.J. Pollock, even over the course of 5 weeks, the final 5 weeks of the season, when he's coming off of an injury, the upside between Pollock and what you might get out of that third or fourth outfielder on a team, the discrepancy there is enormous. So, yeah, Pollock needs to be owned any format and started, really, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, the reverse impact of the long-term injury, like we talked, like you mentioned, the kind of negative aspect that he hasn't faced major league pitching in a long time. The positive side of it, he will be maybe the freshest player in baseball in September. So,
yeah.
You know, almost every player in the majors will say that they're dealing with some type of bump or bruise or cut or something that's bothering them by September, and they're worn down, you know, and they're trying to finish the season strong, and a lot of them aren't in contention anymore, and you know, there's the mental grind of it, and Pollock's going to come in fresh. I know he's not on a contender, but he's going to come in fresh, a lot of energy, something to prove to himself down the stretch and show that he's all the way back. And, you know, you could see him. It wouldn't shock me if he was a top five outfielder in September if they give him let him play every game. And just because of that, like, he's going to be running bases, fresh legs, and looking to kind of just end what's been for him a really frustrating season on a high note.
Yeah, and we keep saying, you know, he hasn't faced major league pitching, but some of the guys that he's going to face in September aren't necessarily going to be major league caliber pitchers.
Especially maybe late Diamondbacks games, in September, because they aren't in contention and they're throwing out some starters that aren't so hot and their bullpen's not so hot. They could be in some lopsided games one way or the other down the stretch.
Which is, you know,
we're going to wrap things up with some two-star pitchers for next week. Really key for a lot of owners. There are, you know, head-to-head leagues that are in playoffs now, and owners who are really trying to get that maximize, even the Roto League, get a few more strikeouts, a couple more wins. We got Tyler Duffy, we got Matt Boyd, Zach Davies, Joe Musgrove, John Gray, Dan Straley, Sean Manaea. These are kind of our fringy mixed league, you know, two-star pitchers for next week. Steve, who are some names and their matchups that jump out at you as, you know, the ones that you would really chase?
I don't have full faith that he's as good as he's been this season, but Dan Straley has been probably the Reds' most consistent starting pitcher. I'm not especially intimidated by the Angels lineup that he's going to be facing early on, and he'll have the benefit of kind of being away from his, you know, homer-friendly home park there anyway. I think of the two-star guys this week, Straley probably is the favorite for me. I like Zach Davies a lot, but he's facing a couple of pretty good teams in the Cardinals and the Pirates. And Joe Musgrove's second start in Texas is a little bit too worrisome for me to kind of chase the upside there.
Yeah, I'm a Musgrove fan, and I really pumped him up last week on the podcast, and then he has not rewarded my faith at all in the past week. But I'm not wavering off him too much. His strikeout to walk ratio is impressive so far. You know, for people who are really jumping off of Musgrove, I believe he's had five appearances now, two against the Blue Jays, one against the Rangers, one against the Orioles, and then the one against the Pirates. So some pretty tough matchups. I'll consider him in a deep league. That Oakland start at home is pretty favorable. And I'll
really
put Matt Boyd as someone who's been really underrated the last few weeks. He used to have early in his career, had some really bad starts, and he's kind of seemed to have been able to right the ship and kind of steady himself to the point where he hasn't allowed more than three runs in a while. And home matchup against the White Sox, not a great lineup. He's going to go on the road, to a pitcher-friendly park and face the Royals, who are unlikely to hit a home run against you. So, you know, maybe they'll single him to death. We'll see. But I think Matt Boyd is showing some positive signs that he could become, you know, a mixed league lineup fixture. The last one I'm going to ask you about is John Gray. Some people love John Gray. Some people don't, just based on the fact that he's a member of the Rockies. He has two home starts next week. Is there any mixed league where you would consider a two home start Rocky starter?
I love John Gray, and I love the skill set, and I'm a believer that he can eventually in time develop into the type of guy who can succeed even at Coors Field. But he has struggled there this year, especially relative to his starts on the road. And both of the teams that you mentioned, I mean, he's not facing, you know, a couple of weak lineups at Coors Field either. If you're in a deeper league, 14 teams or more, and you're really chasing, you know, quality starts at the end of the season, I could see it at that point. But if I'm in a 12 team or certainly in a 10 team league, I'm a little bit too skeptical of facing two lineups like that at Coors Field when he's shown this year that he does have some struggles at home.
Yeah, and I mean, the Dodgers lineup will give him they're pretty good decent against right-handers. They'll give him a tough test. And you know, Arizona, although they don't win a lot of games, when they'll have Pollock back and they've got Goldschmidt and Segura, like their lineup, Tomas, like their lineup has some thumpers in it and some guys who can get on base. So, All right, well, I think that's it. We're going to wrap things up now. I'm going to try to copy Matthew's finish. So, on behalf of Steve Adams, this is Fred Dinky, and I'm going to say, thanks everyone for listening, and thanks, Steve, for taking some time to talk.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me, man.